Welcome to Talking Beats. I hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much more. And remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. On today's program, China expert Bonnie Glaser. She's the director of the China Power Project and senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Prior to joining CSIS, she was a consultant for the U.S. Departments of State and Defense. In addition to her government work, she has published in many journals, including International Security, Far Eastern Economic Review, and China Quarterly. U.S.-China relations, which were already souring before the outbreak of the pandemic that originated in China, have been, according to many experts, in free fall. I wanted to ask my guest if this is correct or an exaggeration. What's the end point? Are we heading for or already in a new Cold War? I have the perfect person to ask, and she's with me now, Bonnie Glaser. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been tracking China, its history, its tendencies for decades, and you look at the intersection of Asia-Pacific geopolitics and U.S. policy. What right now are you honing in on?
Well, I'm following very closely the changes in Chinese foreign policy and also how the world views China. China has been particularly sensitive in recent years on sovereignty issues. We see this with the clashes with India along the border with China. There's a lot of friction between China and Taiwan. There's quite a bit going on in terms of rivalry, not just between the U.S. and China, but also hard edges between China's smaller neighbors and issues in the South China Sea pertaining to resources like oil and gas and fish. And it's really interesting, I think, in the light of the pandemic, how countries are starting to change their perceptions of China. With the developments in internally in China, like the incarceration of Uyghurs in Xinjiang, that's getting more attention. But the fact that China has been less than fully transparent about the pandemic and has really tried to use this opportunity to increase or enhance its international reputation as a provider of public goods to the world, and in some ways has done so abrasively. And countries are beginning to push back. And they're also pushing back against Chinese disinformation. And Australia is a great example of that. So I really see that the views of countries around the world are just becoming more, they're becoming more ambivalent. They want to have good relations with China. They certainly want to benefit from economic ties. But they also see that China is pushing a set of norms and trying to undermine democracies and rule of law around the world and interfering in their societies in ways that just is causing a lot of worry.
You describe what to me, to a non-professional person, to an ordinary American citizen, but to me sounds like a rather generous, a rather benevolent take on China by all these countries around the world, that you said that there's starting to be increased ambivalence. Isn't it maybe a little late for increased ambivalence? Is the rest of the world way behind China in a sense or on understanding what they want?
I do think that all countries have been a little bit slow on the uptake of understanding Chinese ambitions. The Belt and Road Project, which is global, is, you know, perhaps an example. But countries want to benefit from China's economic largesse. They can get loans from China to build infrastructure that it's really difficult for them to obtain elsewhere. So, you know, they they mute their criticisms of China on other issues. And the United States also, I think, has been a little slow to come to understand some of the dangers that China poses. But I also think we have to be a little careful not to overstate the threats that China poses. They are real, and we really do need to understand them. We shouldn't make China 10 feet tall. We should understand, for example, its military capabilities and how they can impact American interests, but we should also understand that they lag behind in many areas, too. They're just to cite one example, the inventory of their nuclear weapons is really small compared to the United States. In fact, even smaller than I think we thought it was. The Defense Department just released its annual report on the Chinese military, and they cited that China's nuclear weapons really are in the low 200s. And of course, the United States is well over 1,000.
Step back for a moment and talk about how you first came to study China. You've been focused on China for decades, all the way back to graduate school. What brought you originally to study China? Where does your personal passion for China come from?
Well, I was actually an undergraduate at the time, and I wanted to study a part of the world that I knew very little about. And that, of course, was Asia, certainly a high school student. I had not really been exposed to anything having to do with Asia. And so when I went to college, I decided to take a class which was in some history of China, Japan, and India. And I really became fascinated in that part of the world. And I ended up designing my own major as an undergraduate around the topic of China as a case study in modernization and why essentially it had failed, because China was, in fact, for so many centuries in the dynastic period, a leader in technology and in so many other areas, and was admired by many of its neighbors and those in the world from Europe and other places that landed on Chinese shores and found Chinese silk and pottery and things that they were really quite advanced in. And so I did an undergraduate investigation into that. And then I lived in Taiwan for a year and a half to study Chinese language. At that time, actually, the opportunities to study Chinese on the mainland were very, very limited. This was just at the beginning of the opening up of China in 1979. And so I went to Taiwan. I did visit mainland China at the time, but I did my language study in Taiwan. And I arrived there 3 weeks after the United States broke diplomatic ties with Taiwan and established them with the People's Republic of China. So I've been passionate about China ever since, and I can say it has never been boring.
Well, as someone who's performed many concerts in mainland China and met the passionate classical music audiences in China, I can say it's definitely not boring, and the food is as exciting and diverse as anywhere, so that's not boring either. So they have two major bases covered, music and food. But Bonnie Glaser, I wonder if you... if you give us a framework, will you, of the Belt and Road Project? It's not maybe something that everybody listening to this podcast is familiar with, as this is sort of a general audience podcast. So give us a broad overview. What is the Belt and Road Project? Is there something sinister behind it?
Well, the Belt and Road Project is so many things. It's really Xi Jinping's flagship foreign policy project to help promote connectivity throughout. It started in the Indo-Pacific region, but really now is global. China talks about the Arctic being now part, essentially, of the Belt and Road, as well as Latin America. And it is to help development in parts of the world. It is also to help Chinese companies find projects that they can engage in, because the work that they've done in China has really created a lot of over capacity that needs to be pushed outward. And in fact, before the Belt and Road, there were a lot of projects going on abroad. China had a policy that it called Zhou Chu, which means going out, pushing the Chinese companies to go abroad and engage in these projects. And so, in a sense, the Belt and Road was putting a name on a trend and a series of projects that were already underway. But it started with the overland projects, and the goal is to connect China with Europe, which has now been achieved by rail. And then on the other side, there's the maritime set of projects, which extends to now, as I said, for many, many parts of the world, including Africa and all of the parts of the Pacific. And so I think there were economic drivers at first, but there it has evolved in the direction where there are security components. China is building bases now all around the world. China is building ports all around the world that could serve as potential bases for their military, and I think that the Pentagon really does have a close eye on this particular issue. The Chinese actually only have one military base so far. That's in Djibouti in Africa, but there's a lot of speculation that they really are building out capabilities in Cambodia. But in many of these other ports, there's the potential just to have dual-use facilities, maybe places where the military can stop and refuel and do maintenance. And maybe have greater military access in the future. So, of course, the U.S. is a global power, doesn't want China to become one militarily and be able to project its power all over the world. But I think there are security concerns. And then I would say that one of the things that really has been very prominent in the news has been the issue of what people call debt traps. And that is, I think, not a function of China deliberately imposing debt on other countries, but maybe not doing due diligence and extending its loans, and countries not having the capability or prioritizing the level of debt in their own countries. And so we've really seen a great deal of debt, particularly in the developing world. Some of these countries may never be able to pay back the loans, and they are loans. They are not grants. This is really not like the Marshall Plan after World War II. China expects to be repaid. So I think this is, it's a very complex project, but Xi Jinping has made it his top priority, I think, in foreign policy. It's now been written into the Chinese constitution, and therefore it will be a success. It will be reported as such, certainly.
The way you describe it makes it sound philosophical as much as physical, the Belt and Road Project, Bonnie Glaser. And I wonder if you could hone in on the bases a little more. It's very striking, this idea of dual use or multi-use ports becoming bases all over the world. What are some of the other parts of the world that can expect to see a Chinese base, a Chinese port other than Cambodia or Djibouti? Where are you talking about? I mean, in our backyard? Is this going to happen? Who's allowing it?
Well, I would highlight in particular the Pacific Islands, which are, of course, quite close to Australia, and they are very concerned about China looking for potential military access in that region of the world. There's also more potential in Southeast Asia. Maybe, as I said, Cambodia would be the most likely target, possibly other countries in Africa. Although the United States has a very close relationship with Israel, China has actually invested in the port in Haifa. And although I doubt that the Israelis would allow the Chinese to use it as a base, it could provide them with the capability to monitor some of what is going on there. And so it could be useful for intelligence purposes. And there are definitely some countries in Europe as well where the Chinese are investing in ports. So the port investment is definitely global. The prospects for military presence are certainly more limited.
I wonder, is there going to be a country who's just going to say, well, we don't want anything to do with a base, we don't want anything to do with a port here, or is it all too tied up together to have that sort of blanket one-off statement.
There are certainly some countries in the world that don't want to have Chinese presence in their ports. So there has been, I think, some pushback. But most of the developing countries, as I said, they want Chinese investment. One country where there has been a fairly successful project is in Greece, where there's a port, Piraeus, where the Chinese investment has increased the commercial activity in the port, and it's generating more revenue. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that, you know, Greece has been fairly positive in its evaluation of that project. So this varies from country to country.
Going to switch a little bit now to the U.S.-China relations. On your podcast, China Power Project, you had recently Lu Xiang from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He described to you a free fall, a plummeting of U.S.-China relations. Was this hyperbole, or do you think this is an accurate assessment, particularly in light of the pandemic?
Well, I often say that U.S.-China relations are in a free fall, and that they are at the worst place now than they have been since, at least since normalization in 1979. So we have a case where our economies are very interdependent. We have enormous people-to-people exchanges. And that very integrated nature of our societies and our economies has actually created an enormous amount of friction. And it really wasn't until the tail end of the Obama administration, and then, of course, accelerating in the Trump administration, that the United States has made an assessment about the really dangerous nature of the predatory policies that China is pursuing. And we see this in trade. The unfair playing field, for example, the subsidies that China provides to state-run companies. We see it certainly in the area of technology, where China is engaged in massive espionage efforts to steal technology from U.S. companies and sometimes research from U.S. universities. We see cyber theft. And then we see issues that relate to Chinese activities in international organizations, where they are trying to dominate those organizations and influence them. And this was definitely true in the case of the World Health Organization when COVID-19 occurred. And China really did not want and does not want to be the target of investigation as the source of the outbreak of the pandemic.
And can I just, if I could just quickly insert that there's a tweet that I remember, it sticks out to me so jaggedly from the WHO, from the World Health Organization in January 2020, which quoted Wuhan health officials as saying quite confidently that there's no human-to-human transmission of COVID-19. And that was the tweet. I looked at it recently. It was hard to believe coming from the WHO. As a simple blanket statement, here's what the health officials in Wuhan said, and we're going to go along right with it.
Well, at that time, I think that the WHO was just simply relating what they were being told by China. And at that time, they were not receiving full information from China either. So the big question, of course, is, what did they know and when? Not only in Wuhan at the local level, but also what they told leaders in Beijing. Was there some information that may have been withheld at the local level in Wuhan because they didn't want to give the center, Beijing, bad news? We see that a lot in China. So there's a lot of blame to go around, which is why I believe, at least, that investigation is really necessary. So that has, I think, accelerated, yes, the decline in U.S.-China relations. And now that we're nearing the presidential election, there's a lot of discussion about Chinese interference, along, of course, with interference by other countries like Russia. in our elections. Senior intelligence officials are saying that China's been engaged in cyber attacks and phishing attacks, trying to penetrate campaigns in our election infrastructure. So every day, it seems like there is a new issue in the U.S.-China relationship in the news. And senior officials have made a spate of speeches about the threats that China poses, not only to American interests overall, but to state and local interests and to U.S. companies and to our allies and friends and democratic partners around the world. And so they're trying to forge a coalition and issue this rallying cry around the issue of the threats that China poses. And so this has really, caused just greater attention to China than ever before. It's not just that we've seen a decline in the U.S.-China relationship. You know, I'll just quickly cite just a couple of statistics. You know, the latest Pew poll, which took place after the onset of the pandemic, so I think this was around the June-July timeframe, found that 73% of Americans have a negative opinion, an unfavorable opinion toward China. That is a 7-point increase over March, which was the last time they had asked that question. And it's actually the highest rate of negative opinion since Pew started asking this question in its surveys in 2005. So it's really fascinating how Americans, they're absorbing the news cycle and the headlines, but also it's because of their own experience in the pandemic. There's a lot of negativity. And in Congress, I think just in the last 6 months, we've seen hundreds of new bills that have been put forward relating to China and trying to protect American interests and make America more resilient in the face of Chinese challenges.
You mentioned the recent Pew poll, 73% of Americans polled having a negative view of China. If I were to ask you crudely your opinion of this poll, where do you stand? I mean, it's difficult to say positive or negative when you know as much as you do and there are gradations and gray areas. But where, I mean, you obviously love studying the U.S. and China. You've had a passion for China for decades, as we've said. Where do you stand right now?
Oh, I definitely have an unfavorable opinion of Chinese Communist Party policies, both at home and abroad. I do try to distinguish those as the administration does. I mean, there is a difference between Xi Jinping and the party and the Chinese people, although I'm not in favor of some of the things that Trump administration officials have said regarding empowering the Chinese people to induce change or stand up to the Chinese Communist Party. So I don't go that far. But I do think that it is the party's policies, of course, that are the problems. And I'm quite concerned about their policies at home against individuals who are minorities in Tibet and Xinjiang. I'm very concerned about their policies against dissidents. And frankly, I think increasingly foreigners are at risk in China when they visit. We just had two Australian journalists who apparently came quite close to being detained, and they were able to get quickly taken out of the country. And we know that it has been over a year since China detained two Canadian citizens, and they have been kept because they were detained directly because the Canadian government had detained and arrested Meng Wanzhou, who was the chief financial officer of Huawei, wanted by the United States. And the United States wants her extradited to the U.S. And of course, now this is all bogged down in all sorts of complicated legal procedures. But yes, this is a tactic that China was willing to use against Canada to try to get Canada to free Ms. Meng.
I know you're not a cybersecurity specialist per se, but what do you see when you mentioned Huawei? What do you see when you look at, say, TikTok? You look at Zoom, even the one of the most widely used video conferencing and audio conferencing platforms, which seems to have rather strange ties to China. TikTok is obviously Chinese, pure and simple, but Zoom as well. We're not communicating over Zoom right now, so I feel I can ask you, what have you heard? I was reading strange stories about certain accounts being suspended over Zoom when they were holding events related to China's crackdown in Tiananmen Square, for example. Direct requests from the Chinese government to Zoom to suspend these accounts. How much does that bother you?
China has undue influence over quite a number of U.S. companies and other multinational companies who really want to make profit in China. For many years, Facebook was trying to make inroads into China and they weren't very successful, and now they're more critical of China. But we've seen other companies make compromises, look for ways to make deals. We've seen this trend in Hollywood, and the latest movie, Mulan, has encountered a lot of trouble because they work quite closely with some of these entities, including the Ministry of State Security and Ministry of Public Security in Xinjiang. And these are the people who are incarcerating Uyghurs. So there's a lot of influence that China has, whether it's international organizations like in the WHO or dealing with companies. And for companies, it's their bottom line. We recently had Attorney General William Barr make just a scathing speech criticizing these companies for putting profits ahead of what should be democratic principles and our morals and our ethics. And so that's a work in progress. I do think that some companies really do care about the impact that their policies might be having, and they don't want to hire, for example, labor in China. Now it's probably illegal because of American sanctions, you know, to be actually establishing a factory or buying products from a factory where the labor could be, they could be Uyghurs who are actually imprisoned and being compelled to produce these items. So this, of course, all requires more investigation and should be driven by facts. I very much believe in policies being underpinned by facts. But, TikTok, we have to define what the problem is. If the issue is data protection, then we should be able to come up with ways that we can be confident that we can protect the data, the privacy of American citizens. That should be a very important concern for the United States. I doubt that the only way we can do that is by banning TikTok. There's probably other technical means that we can use to do that. So we shouldn't start with a just massive step like banning companies. We should try to figure out if there's other means that we can use to achieve the goals that we need, that we want to achieve.
Let's take a quick break for a second so I can ask you about music, because after all, I always ask everybody on this show about their favorite music. Bonnie Glazer, what music do you love? What do you listen to? It's Talking Beats, after all.
I like a lot of different kinds of music. There's music from when my younger years, we'll go back, let's say, to the 1970s. There's music that I go back to there, and people like Carole King and Carly Simon and James Taylor, and that's some of my early loves in music. Today I listen to a lot of light jazz. I like Sade. I saw her in concert once and thought she was really fabulous. And I really miss attending concerts.
you and me both.
Yes, I'm sure. But I guess I'm still partial to a lot of the music of my childhood. And that's, Moody Blues and Pink Floyd Aztec two-step. So abroad, I think I had pretty eclectic tastes at the time. But music is an important part of my life, and especially in the pandemic. I find if I'm depressed, that's what I do, is I turn on some music.
A few friends of mine, well-known classical musicians who were on recently, they said, well, Vivaldi has gotten us through the COVID-19. We sit at home. They're three siblings, all violinists and violists, and they sit at home, and when they feel down, they put on Vivaldi, and they said, you just can't help but smile when you have Vivaldi on. I agree. Bonnie Glaser, you mentioned Taiwan before. It's a place you've been intimately familiar with for a long time. You studied there. You've been tracking it. The relationship China-Taiwan, what's happening now as we go into fall of 2020?
Well, Taiwan has a president who was democratically elected first in 2016 and then reelected earlier this year in January. And she is from a party that traditionally stands for Taiwan independence. She has pursued very prudent and cautious policies from my perspective, although I recognize that some people in China have a different point of view, because she just hasn't accepted the notion that Taiwan is part of China. And that is a precondition for Beijing to deal with her and with really anybody who's an official in Taiwan. So China cut all communications with Taiwan that are official and has been really ramping up pressure on Taiwan economically, diplomatically, and particularly militarily. We see Chinese fighter jets and bombers circumnavigating the island, crossing the what we call the center line between the mainland Chinese side and Taiwan, behaving in really provocative ways. There's been just thousands of cyber attacks going on almost on a daily basis. It's remarkable how much cyber activity there is. Certainly a lot of disinformation. And people are concerned because the military, the People's Liberation Army, has been developing capabilities that could be used to actually attack Taiwan. And we don't know whether that could happen in the near term or in the longer term. Xi Jinping has said some tough things about Taiwan. He has said reunification of the two sides is inevitable. And he has said that differences between the two sides should not be passed down from generation to generation. And he has said that ultimately his Chinese dream of national rejuvenation by 2049 really has to include unification with Taiwan. So that has led to some discussion and debate about whether there's actually now a deadline for unification. So, you know, the United States used to have a mutual security treaty with Taiwan and, of course, broke that when it established diplomatic ties with the PRC. But we still have commitments to Taiwan. We are not required legally to come to Taiwan's defense if it's attacked. That would be a decision that would be made at the time by the president and the Congress. But instead, we have a position that is somewhat ambiguous because we don't want to give Taiwan a blank check to do stupid things like that could, you know, maybe it might embolden some people in Taiwan to push for independence if we say the United States will come to Taiwan's defense under every circumstance. So we basically warn both sides, don't unilaterally change the status quo. But there's far more concern today about Chinese policies than there are about Taiwan's policies, although there have been times in the past where Taiwan has pushed the envelope and, frankly, gotten some warnings from the U.S. to not pull us into a war with China in the Taiwan Strait. But there's enormous attention that's being paid now to this issue, much more than ever before. And then in addition to the military factor, I would mention the issue of Taiwan's just growing isolation. China, any organization around the world, even if it's not part of the UN, if China is a member, it will not allow Taiwan to participate. And it even prevents Taiwanese citizens from visiting as tourists the UN headquarters in New York, because if they show a ROC passport, they can't get in. But if they have an ID card that is issued by Beijing, well, then they're welcome. So people from I think Taiwan do feel increasingly isolated. Taiwan, of course, when it was a member of the UN and it lost that membership in 1971, you know, it used to have diplomatic ties with lots of countries. And over the years, they virtually all switched their diplomatic allegiance to the PRC. And now Taiwan has 15 diplomatic partners left. And most of them are very small countries around the world. So the United States sells arms to Taiwan. We try to help Taiwan increase its voice and participation in the international community. We do have to sustain robust deterrence. We have to prevent China from miscalculating or thinking that it could get away with an attack on Taiwan. And in that regard, there's much more that the U.S. has to do. We just haven't been keeping up.
You used an expression that sounded quite foreign to me a few sentences ago, deadline for unification. What does that mean? That sounds a little scary.
It is scary, and I'm not convinced that Xi Jinping has set a deadline, but I do mention it because there is a debate. When Jiang Zemin was president and the general secretary of the party in China, he really seriously talked about setting a date certain, a deadline, by which he would reunify Taiwan with force. And U.S. officials at the time strongly discouraged him from going forward with that. And eventually, I think we were successful. And so the idea that this is now coming up again is really very worrisome. You know, even though it's 2020 today and 2049 is obviously, 29 years away, it's really not that far away. And we don't want to see China going down this, inexorable path of saying by this date, if Taiwan does not agree to become part of the PRC, that we will just use military force in order to achieve that goal. It would be really damaging, I think. It's not just for American interests and other countries and for Taiwan, but I think it would be very damaging for China if they were to seek to achieve unification through military force. And it probably would escalate to a much broader war, including a U.S.-China war.
The surveillance state that's being built in China or that exists in China, in terms of the cultural impacts, do you think there's a general malaise in China among the populace about this surveillance state, or is it so de rigueur that it's sort of, well, just that?
I think that a lot of the citizens in China feel safe as a result of the surveillance. There probably are some numbers of people who oppose it. But it is really presented to the population as something that's necessary for public safety. And to be fair, there are probably as many CCTV cameras and other equipment in London as there are in Beijing. There are many cities in the world that have a lot of surveillance. The question really is not the technology, it's how it's used. And to me, it's potentially very scary that the Chinese can identify a person's face in a matter of minutes, no matter where they are, because of the database that they have built, and then how they potentially use that. That's what really worries me. But I'll mention something else. The Chinese created a social credit system. And my understanding from people who've done research on this is that the Chinese people actually like the idea of getting extra points if they do nice things for their neighbors or they abide by the rules, and they get points taken away if they violate the rules. And I think most Americans would just be horrified with that kind of intrusion into our lives. But my understanding is from people who've done some social science research here, they find that most Chinese people actually think that this is a good idea, that people who don't behave according to the law should be punished. And if they can't get on a train or a plane because that's the punishment for having a low social credit score, then so be it. That's the way things should be. So it's a very different attitude, I think, of people in China, in part because they've lived under this system for such a long time. And I think it's also fair to say that in the current situation of democracy in the United States and also some other countries, where we are not really successfully addressing some of our problems that's been created by income equality and racial inequality. We have the pandemic raging throughout the United States. China has handled these things very differently. And of course, it tells its citizens, look at the failed model of democracy and the effectiveness of China's socialist model. And it sends that message to other countries around the world. And so this is a challenge for us, that we have to do our job better of showing that our system works, that we can provide good governance to our people, or other countries in the world are going perhaps to see that there is some value in taking some lessons from China's model.
What are you worried about as we go into elections here in the U.S. coming into fall 2020? As you look around what's happening in the world, what are you worried about for the short term, the next few months going into 2021, in terms of U.S.-China relations and also in terms of what China may try to do? It seems like there's so many stories in the news right now that a lot of things don't get as much coverage as they perhaps deserve. Are there things you think China might try to do now that could slip under the radar?
There's a lot to worry about, I suppose, but I'm really worried about one large issue, and that is that China has a long attached priority to preserving a stable relationship with the United States. We're the sole superpower. We can damage Chinese interests. We can prevent China from actually achieving the dream of national rejuvenation. And in the past, China's value that it accorded to that relationship has in some instances led China to modify its behavior. This is, of course, for many years of working together, beginning with our, of course, cooperation against the Soviet Union, which is the origin of the U.S.-China relationship under President Nixon. And that expanded, of course, to other issues. And so everybody in the United States is just worried about China stealing all of our stuff, which is reasonable. But there's this impact of China deciding that the U.S.-China relationship cannot be improved, and that they should stop investing in it, and that the United States is now an enemy, that the U.S. wants to pursue regime change in China to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party, and that therefore to protect Chinese interests, they just should give up caring about this bilateral relationship. And if they really reach that conclusion, I think that opens up the real potential for what some people are saying already exists. There's a new Cold War, we really could be in this existential global systemic rivalry with China around the world, that I think would be, frankly, very much against American interests, and I'm not sure we're fully prepared for it. Not that I think it's inevitable we would lose. I just think the process of this rivalry would be terribly damaging to the United States. So what I worry about is that the Trump administration has been hammering China and using this pandemic as a cudgel to some extent. Vice President Biden, of course, does not want to appear weak on China and recognizes himself the challenges that China poses. And so he has made tough statements on China. So over the next few months, this relationship is just going to continue to deteriorate. There's no constituency in the United States that's standing up for the relationship. Years ago, the business community was this strong pillar for the U.S.-China relationship, and now that is virtually evaporated. And so it's just a question as to who can be tougher on China. And so once this election is over and we get a new president, we still have to work with China. We have to be able to deal with the Chinese Communist Party and talk to their government and try to solve problems. And I just think we're going to be very ill-equipped to do that. There's going to be very little that's left to pick up and then start from. Well, this relationship is going to be in the worst shape ever.
Well, Bonnie Glazer, something tells me that there's going to be a lot more to talk about with you, and I hope you'll come back sometime. In the meantime, I thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. I hope you'll subscribe and leave a review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. The original theme music for this program is by Ronald Markham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse. Doug Christian is the executive producer. I'm Daniel Lalchuk. See you next time.